there is still going to be a lot of polarizing factors in Thai politics.
Vote counting continues in Thailand. It's Tuesday, March 26th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, vigils continue in New Zealand. Tensions are down but simmering between India and Pakistan. A Chinese-built dam begins to power Uganda, diagnosing a painful disease and climate change flooding. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Thais waited Monday for the results of an election called a return to democratic rule, but which has been widely criticized as an exercise designed by Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha to entrench his military stranglehold on power. Preliminary official results released late Sunday showed that with 93% of the ballots counted, the military-backed Falang Parachat Party was in the lead with about 7.6 million votes. That's short of what would be needed for a majority in parliament. In second place was the Pheu Thai Party of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat with 7.1 million votes. The campaign was marred by allegations of vote buying. However, complaints were few on polling day with election observers from Australia, Canada, the United States, and the 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations on hand. Security was tight and opinions were mixed as about 52 million Thais voted. But the long shadow of the military is still having an impact, and most of those willing to express an opinion declined to be identified. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about the Thai vote with Ian Beard, director of the Center for Southeast Asia Studies at the University of Wisconsin.
There are people that are making various allegations about whether there has been some interference in the vote, you know, double voting or things like this. The turnout seems to be a lot lower than people expected, which also has raised some questions. These are just allegations at this point, and it's hard to know how much truth is in them. It's still going to take a long time for them to figure out the party vote proportion of the seats. That won't be announced until early May. So there's a lot of speculation right now and uncertainty. It would appear that, on the one hand, the military party has a great advantage because they start off with 250 seats, presumably coming from the unelected members. However, they may require to have a coalition partner, and at this point it's not clear who that might be or if any of the other parties are willing to enter into a coalition with the pro-military party.
What are the problems associated with the military party not winning?
I think either way, there is still going to be a lot of polarizing factors in Thai politics, right? Because the constitution of Thailand is set up in such a way now that it's not really a fully democratic system because you have one-third of the seats are now given to the military to appoint. So, you know, this is a very uncertain situation right now because it seems that the same sort of divisions that have been plaguing Thailand for many years are continuing.
There have been some suggestions and some predictions that this might lead to a stronger military takeover, maybe even a violent coup. Have you come to that same conclusion?
I would not say that at this point. There have been some speculation on that front, but I don't think there's enough evidence at this point to say that is a likely scenario. It really depends on how things play out in the next days and even weeks. You know, because the coalition parties, even the Pheu Thai party may only have, 37% of the seats, the elected seats, not including the non-elected ones, of the 500 seats that are elected. So that being the case, they're also going to have coalition partners if they were to try to form a government. And I think the Future Forward Party would certainly be an obvious ally. There's still a lot to be determined here.
How strong is the military still in Thailand? This is basically for our listeners and readers who are not following this on an everyday basis.
Well, the military in Thailand is very powerful. And, of course, Thailand has the history of a very large number of coups and attempted coups over many decades. And so the military has not simply, kept to the barracks and dealt with military affairs. They've often inserted themselves into politics. It is what is happening right now because they are attempting to convert, a government that was based on a military coup into a civilian military government with a new constitution that the military essentially wrote, and which gives the military a major role in politics to try to basically prevent the parties that were in some ways linked to Thaksin Shinawatra, who was removed in a coup in 2006, and then later his sister, when she became prime minister afterwards, was also removed in a coup. And so they're trying to prevent their supporters from returning to power.
What do you think is going to happen, and what do you think the state of affairs is overall?
Well, I think the state of affairs is uncertain. I don't expect that there'll be, in the immediate future, there'll be a lot of violence happening in Thailand. I don't think that will be a concern. But I do think that the way the constitution in Thailand is written now is not satisfactory to a lot of people there. And so I think we can expect to see more, that the political situation is not going to be smooth going ahead, I don't think.
Ian Beard, director of the Center for Southeast Asia Studies at the University of Wisconsin, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Military-backed party leads in Thai elections. New Zealand launching fact-finding inquiry into mosque attacks. U.S. Navy and Coast Guard ships pass through strategic Taiwan Strait. How will foreign investment change Vietnam's economy? China and Philippines living by tacit deals at sea despite sovereignty dispute. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories with videos and photos and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thousands of people attended a vigil in Christchurch, New Zealand to protest racism and to remember the 50 Muslims who were killed in two mosques last week by a white nationalist. Many of the women in attendance continued making and wearing headscarves in solidarity with their Muslim neighbors. Arash Arabasadi reports.
Volunteers come together Sunday, sewing headscarves at a community center in Christchurch, New Zealand.
Well, personally, I love sewing, and this is a way that I can contribute, doing something that I enjoy. And no, I have no problem at all with... I was wearing a headscarf myself earlier on, and I'm fine with anybody that to show their face.
Libby Davis lives in Christchurch. There, a gunman opened fire during Friday prayers at two mosques on March 15th, killing 50 people. A week later, the greater community mourned the victims. Since then, women in Christchurch donned headscarves in support of the Muslim community.
We just want to let them know that we're there for them, and we've heard that some Muslims haven't felt safe going out in their headscarves, and we want to show them that it's still a safe community even though the terror attack has happened.
The vigil comes just 2 days after the first Friday prayers since the massacre.
I loved it. Like, on Friday, I went to the Friday prayer, and I couldn't tell who was Muslim, who wasn't, and it was really heartwarming. And then my professor also wore the hijab, and a few classmates of mine wore the hijab, too, and it's, like, really awesome to see. I definitely support it.
Thousands attended Sunday's vigil in Christchurch. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has called the shooting a terror attack and announced changes to the country's gun laws with support from the head of New Zealand's police association. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
The World Health Organization is praising India's landmark achievement of ridding the country of the crippling polio virus. This coming Wednesday, the WHO says India's 1.3 billion people and the entire WHO Southeast Asia region will celebrate 5 years of being polio-free. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says 12 years ago, India alone was responsible for almost 70% of all polio cases around the world. It calls India's success against polio one of the most significant achievements in public health. WHO officials say India's accomplishment proves the crippling disease can be eliminated in even the most challenging circumstances with a strong political commitment. The number of polio cases has decreased from an estimated 350,000 a year to 33 since the WHO launched its global eradication campaign in 1988. WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer tells VOA polio remains endemic in only 3 countries in 2 of the organization's 6 regions. He identifies the countries as Nigeria in the African region and Pakistan and Afghanistan in the eastern Mediterranean region.
There has been no wild poliovirus detected in Africa since 2016, and we are cautiously optimistic that Afro, so our African region, is on the path to certification as well. EMRO, our eastern Mediterranean region, has only those 2 countries which have never stopped polio, unfortunately, Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Lindemeyer says the countries are considered a joint reservoir of the virus. Therefore, he says both are getting most of the focus and support from the WHO's polio eradication program. He says tailored and innovative tactics are being put in place to deal with the challenges in each country. The strategies include identifying, tracking, and vaccinating migrant and hard-to-reach populations. He says community workers will be trained to go door-to-door to hunt down children who haven't been vaccinated and immunize them against polio. The World Health Organization notes the polio virus does not respect borders. It says polio will not be eradicated until every last child is protected. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, a military-backed party is leading in Thailand's first election since a 2014 coup. Preliminary results show, suggesting junta leader and Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha could stay in power, helped by an electoral system tilted in the military's favor. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Nearly a month ago, tensions quickly rose between India and Pakistan, and that raised fears the two nuclear-armed neighbors were moving toward war. One region, Kashmir, a disputed territory both countries want, suffered the brunt of the crisis. Cross-border shelling forced people to flee, disrupting lives and livelihoods. Hostilities have eased since then with the help of intense international diplomacy, but the situation is still not back to normal, and many who return to Kashmir fear tensions will rise again. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Chakoti, Kashmir.
This mother is doing everything to give her kids a normal routine here in Kashmir's border town of Chakoti. But the children are still suffering the effects of all the fighting around them.
I cooked last night, but these kids did not eat. They were just too afraid. Firing scared them.
Classes have resumed in this town battered by fighting between India and Pakistan, but attendance is low. some families who fled in February when fighting escalated between the two nuclear-armed countries are trickling back. Chakoti, on the Pakistani side, faced some of the worst shelling. At the peak of the hostilities, almost the entire population was forced to flee, many in the middle of the night and on foot due to the heavy firing.
Only a few people have returned here or there. Some shops are open now, but it's not the same hustle and bustle we used to have in the bazaar.
Indian and Pakistani armies regularly fire at each other in Kashmir across what is known as the line of control. It's the de facto border in a disputed region that both countries want to own fully, but each controls only partially. Fears that the fighting would escalate toward war grew last month when Indian planes entered Pakistani territory to destroy what India claimed were terrorist training camps, an accusation Pakistan denied. Though tensions have eased, life remains uneasy. Some have built bunkers, but many are left exposed. Residents say as they try to return to normal, they live in fear tensions will rise again, and uncertainty about their fate if they do. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Chakoti.
Coming up, China brings water power to Uganda. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. South Korea said some North Korean officials returned to an inter-Korean liaison office Monday, 3 days after the North abruptly withdrew its entire staff, citing unspecified instructions from, quote, higher-level authorities. Visit VOA 60 for more and VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Uganda has launched a Chinese-built hydropower dam in the eastern part of the country, which will improve access to power, but at the cost of the local environment. The $568 million Isimba hydropower dam will cut electricity costs and put more Ugandans on the power grid in a country where less than 30% of the population has access to power. But as Halima Atumani reports from Kayunga, the dam comes at a price for the local people and ecology.
The Victoria Nile River is for many locals the only water source for cleaning, bathing and drinking. But a fence for the just-completed Isimba Hydropower Dam is cutting off their access.
Our children would swim whenever they wanted, but now that's not possible. As a mother, I would send my child to fetch water. That's not possible. They open the dam water 24 hours, and this place floods.
The dam, constructed by China International Water and Electric Corporation, will increase electricity access to the less than 30% of Ugandans who have it and cut power costs. But it has come at a price for the local ecology as well. Before the dam, this Uganda part of the Nile River brought tourists to its waterfalls and wildlife. At the launch Thursday, officials acknowledged choosing 183 megawatts of clean power over access to water and a natural beauty.
It's been a delicate balance for government, but we have to make that choice. And therefore, with the coming in place of this hydropower station, it meant that, of course, would disrupt the social setting up of the communities around.
Critics say China's infrastructure projects in Africa increase Beijing's influence on the continent along with African debt. China's ambassador to Uganda, Zeng Zhuqiang, calls the allegations groundless.
On the contrary, in pursuing cooperation, China values sincerity, friendship and equality, pursue common interests, win-win cooperation and put friendship first.
In addition to the Isimba Dam, China is also financing the $2 billion US, 600-megawatt Karuma hydropower dam in northern Uganda. Once active, The two hydropower dams will nearly double Uganda's power supply. Uganda's future generations will see if the electricity is worth the cost. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kayunga, Uganda.
This news from VOA Asia. Chinese President Xi Jinping arrived in Paris as part of a six-day European tour aimed at bolstering trade with Europe. Meanwhile, in Beijing, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang met with business leaders from multiple nations visiting for the China Development Forum. You'll find more on VOA 60 and stop by VOA Asia Facebook online. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, millions of people live with the constant pain of fibromyalgia. It's a disorder that's often misdiagnosed, and while lab tests can help identify a lot of diseases, until recently there was no test for fibromyalgia. Now, as VOA's Carol Pearson reports, a simple blood test could finally give these patients scientific proof of their condition.
Barb Hartung suffered unexplained full body pain before she was diagnosed with fibromyalgia.
It was almost a relief because I finally knew what was wrong with me.
Fibromyalgia is a disorder with symptoms of widespread pain accompanied by fatigue and problems with sleep, memory, and mood. Researchers believe with fibromyalgia, the brain magnifies signals of pain. About 75% of those who suffer from fibromyalgia are undiagnosed. Some people live with pain for years. Many receive treatment that's ineffective or even harmful.
Many of the patients with chronic opiate use turn out to have underlying fibromyalgia. So in fact, if that was recognized, then we could realize that we could stem the tide of treating them inappropriately with opiates.
Researchers at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center have developed a simple blood test that could diagnose fibromyalgia. While there's no cure for fibromyalgia, medication, exercise, and stress reduction measures can help control symptoms. Barb Hartung takes medication and sticks to a daily routine.
And it's not just giving me a pill, it's how do I live? And for me, it's exercise.
Researchers now want to use the test on a larger group of patients with the hope of getting it out of the lab and into the exam room where doctors could diagnose fibromyalgia instantly. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
As climate change heats up, we can expect more extreme weather events, more hurricanes, and droughts over time. But small flooding events will also become more common. And while not exactly catastrophic, according to a new report, these events are already taking a toll on some local communities. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
When people think of climate change, they generally think of extreme weather, like droughts and hurricanes. Certainly, there will be more of those, and they will be more intense as the planet heats up. But a new study by Stanford researchers suggests that smaller flooding events like these are also having an increasing impact on coastal communities.
Water is rushing into roadways, coming up through the storm drain, and having different types of impacts in really short floods that don't leave all that much lasting damage.
The researchers wanted to see the impact small floods have on coastal communities. They chose the tourist destination of Annapolis, Maryland, that gets about 60 days a year of high tide flooding. A little bit of water, it turns out, can really dampen tourists' enthusiasm.
We found that 2% of visitors aren't coming because of flooding. So 3,000 fewer people are going to those businesses because of floods.
And as climate change heats up, that's only going to get worse, which means fewer tourist dollars. The good news is that these cities know what's coming.
These types of choices are really important because over the course of this century, many millions of Americans face the potential for inundation from sea level rise. And it's really a new frontier to figure out how we'll adapt and prepare.
Studies predict many Americans means between 4 to 13 million who will be threatened by sea level rise in the coming century. That's way more than the system can absorb. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the radio throughout Asia on great radio stations like PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University. That's in Thailand. We thank everyone there who's tuned into our program today. And as always, we thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team is Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. And if you liked our Facebook feed, we thank our intern Yellen for bringing that to us today. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day.